4. And that presentation is entitled Restoring Rangeland Soil Health. Can it mitigate climate change, increase food security, and reduce poverty and conflict? By Jeff Herrick, S. Brenguzzo, Bestemeyer, Brown, Elias, Havistad, Johnson, Peters, and Stott. Now, Dr. Herrick is a soil scientist with the ARS at the Jornada Research Unit in Las Cruces, New Mexico, and holds an adjunct faculty appointment at New Mexico State University in Boulder at Colorado University. He led or co-led development of the nationally adopted rangeland assessment and monitoring protocols. He currently serves as the U.S. government's science representative to the United Nations Convention to Combat Desertification, and leads development of the Global Land Potential Knowledge System, Land PKS Project. Dr. Herrick, where are you? Thank you. Pointer, if you need.
Thanks very much, and thanks to Henry for a very moving presentation that I think aptly demonstrated that we really do hold the earth in our hands. And I really like this photograph. It was actually a spontaneous action by some fellows in a land restoration training program in Iceland at the end of a morning of a very cold experiential opportunity, I guess is the best way to put it, to get their hands into the earth. And at the end of it, I think they demonstrated their appreciation in this way. So this talk, we're going to talk about, cover 5 points. Who cares? And what is rangeland soil quality or soil health? Sorry, Doug, I'm still stuck as well. Claims versus evidence, land potential, the concept, a strategy very briefly, and mobile apps, perhaps a part of the solution. I wanted to end, being at the end of this session, I wanted to end with some practical strategies following on the really nice presentation by Henry and Bianca. So first, who cares? I've just been absolutely stunned in the last 2 months at what's come out both from the White House and also from the United Nations. And the second quote here, I've spent enough time in Washington to know that you never really know where an idea comes from. And so I have to assume that what Wayne and Bianca have been doing and what Bruce has been doing in Washington pushing these concepts has been part of what has led to things like this White House memo on mitigation. If you haven't had a chance to take a look at it, it really is pushing the United States as far as we possibly can within our current legal limits to address restoration and mitigation of land and soil. It's pretty neat. It is a policy document, so it's a little dry, but it's really impressive. So thanks to anyone who had anything to do with that in this room. I certainly didn't. And secondly, the Agenda for Sustainable Development 2030, recently adopted by the UN General Assembly, included a goal that specifically speaks to us in this room. By 2030, to combat desertification, restore degraded land and soil, including land affected by desertification, drought, and floods, and strive to achieve a land degradation neutral world. This was subsequently adopted as the focus of the activities of the United Nations Convention to Combat Desertification at the COP in October 15 in Ankara, Turkey. Again, what a phenomenal opportunity. I realize that in this country, we don't spend a huge amount of time paying attention to UN pronouncements. But the response of the Mongolian president to the Sustainable Development Goals was to propose that all political parties of the world should adopt them as their platform in their election campaigns. So even though we may not pay a lot of attention to the United Nations, there are other countries that do, and I think it's really important that we continue to engage in the process of supporting those countries. And certainly, in my role there, I constantly refer to our experiences, both the negative, the Dust Bowl, and the positive, NRCS, in my conversations with my colleagues internationally. So soil health, rangeland health, and rangeland soil health, are they different? And this is something that's an ongoing debate, and I think probably a largely unnecessary one. First, it's just take it for granted that most rangeland managers do tend to focus on the plant community. It's what they see, it's what their livestock consume, it's what protects the soil from raindrop impact. It responds, as Bianca pointed out when she was talking about Wyoming, it's what responds to the rains. You have more plant growth, you have more soil inputs, you have more biological activity. We don't really have two elephants in most of our rangeland soils. We probably have, you know, a couple of maybe small bears. Well, that's a carnivore. But anyway, but we certainly do have a lot of soil biological activity, and it's incredibly important. So a few studies have actually demonstrated that soil health can serve as an early warning indicator. So there are times when vegetation alone is insufficient. And this is a study that we did back in the last century, and basically found that even though grass cover was the same in a grassland and a grassland exclosure, not statistically different, the soil surface aggregate stability was actually quite a bit higher, particularly in the bare spaces that tended to be smaller between plants. So we had the same amount of grass cover, but the spatial distribution was different. There was more microbiotic crust cover, and as a result, this is on a scale from 1 to 6, we had significantly higher aggregate stability. And as Henry pointed out, or Harold pointed out, I'm sorry, that is probably one of the two most significant indicators that we have of soil health, was actually higher in the exclosure. And that's important because it tells us something about the tolerance to disturbance of this system. This is a semi-arid system, about 230 millimeters. Similarly, and this is really important for us because we do get extreme events, infiltration was also quite a bit higher, as indicated by the shorter amounts of time for 1 inch, or about 2.5 centimeters, to infiltrate into the soil. So there are certainly times, even though for the most part we tend to focus on vegetation, and particularly perennial vegetation, unless we're in California, in our rangeland soils, there are times when it's really important to pay attention to some of these soil factors. Fortunately, we actually have a protocol in place, the Interpreting Indicators of Rangeland Health Assessment, that includes a number of rangeland soil health, or simply soil health, indicators. And in fact, this is something I think that we haven't looked at. It would be really interesting to take a look at this massive data set, tens of thousands of field observations and measurements across both public and private lands. The BLM has also now adopted this, where we've actually made observations relative to potential. So we actually, unlike with the scoring curves, we have actually established what the potential is for each of these indicators. We then do an assessment, and it's a soil-based potential, soil-specific. And we have all these indicators. And I know from looking at the data anecdotally that there are a number of places where the vegetation's fine. So we have three attributes: biotic integrity, soil and site stability, and hydrologic function. Biotic integrity attribute shows up as being fine at potential, but soil and site stability, the hydrologic function, and some of the individual indicators within those are showing that we have some problems. So again, I think there's some opportunities here to figure out where rangeland soil health, or where soil health on rangelands, is necessary to manage our lands, and where we can really just keep on just managing the vegetation. And I think that will help us quite a lot in our communication with the range community. So some good data analysis. If there are any graduate students out there that don't want to go to the field, this is a phenomenal data set. Happy to talk to you about it later on. Okay, claims versus evidence. And this is something, boy, I spend an awful lot of my time dealing with, both domestically and internationally. Just one example, shrubs are great for carbon. They put it deep into the soil. They're bad for forage, and they're often bad for soil erosion if the shrubs happen to outcompete the grasses. Also, but shrubs won't grow in some places. And there are a lot of programs around the world now for mitigation reasons that are trying to plant woody species all over the place. Afforestation seems to have become the word for COP21. okay? And it's being promoted primarily, actually, by the industrialized countries, which would rather not reduce our emissions. It's a lot easier to plant trees. But on the other hand, there are a lot of parts of the world where they want to kill shrubs to improve soil quality. Unfortunately, in some places, and I've got a colleague, Brandon Bestelmeyer, that's done some really interesting research working with the Restore New Mexico program. It's a 1 million acre shrub eradication program in New Mexico, funded by your tax dollars, which is actually having a fairly positive impact in a lot of areas, but not in others, where actually there was no potential for forage production. So now we've killed the shrubs and we have no grass, and soil quality is declining. So again, scientific knowledge really can play a role, and then obviously looking at some of these interactions as we have climate change coming on. Climate mitigation. For those of you who are not among the 3.32124 million people who have seen or had seen as of November 15th, the Alan Savory video in which he claimed that widespread implementation of a prescribed grazing system can take us back to pre-industrial atmospheric levels. Okay, I would love to believe that. Unfortunately, the evidence is that it won't work. Now, does the Savory method or holistic management work in some places at some times? Absolutely. I've seen it do phenomenal things. The first dairy farm I ever worked on in New Zealand was using it, and to really positive effect. Can it do some of the kinds of things it's saying? No. And can it actually have negative impacts in many cases? Absolutely yes. Another example, keyline pasture plowing is now being promoted literally across all soils in the East and the West with some really fairly stunning claims. This was developed in Australia, and there are some places in Australia that I've seen where, although unfortunately there's not a lot of research on it, there is certainly anecdotal evidence that it works really well. And from a soil process perspective, there are some soils in some conditions where keyline plowing makes sense. There are others where it makes no sense at all. And Rachel Gilker, who has a blog, decided that she wanted to go out and find out where it fell on Rachel's Believe It or Not meter. I really like this. So I don't know if you can read, but it goes from that's realistic, it could happen. Really? Not so fast, Buster. Am I in candid camera? And when pigs fly, right? So she put keyline pasture plowing right around here in not so fast, Buster, based on just one study on one soil, right? But it was the only one she had. Okay, so obviously more research required. We need to get out there, work with producers, and we'll talk about that more later. Another claim that I made. Soil degradation and social stability feedbacks lead to violent conflict through reduced food security and land degradation. I really believe this. When we wrote this in a chapter we published recently in a book edited by Ratan Lal, we kind of argued for a while on whether or not we could really justify it. And we went into the literature, and there's certainly some evidence to support this, but it's relatively weak, anecdotal, and somewhat circumstantial. And so I think even though we can draw really nice diagrams like this, again, we really need to be looking for the evidence and qualifying our statements as and when necessary. So in conclusion for this section of the talk, can restoring rangeland help? Largely through vegetation management, but paying attention to soil processes and functions. Can it mitigate climate change, increase food security, and reduce poverty and climate? Well, yes. I mean, it can certainly contribute to these things, but claims are often overstated and overgeneralized. And I think it's just important as a soil science community that we continue to engage those who are promoting silver bullets and work with them as opposed to either just shooting them down and saying you're full of it or jumping on the bandwagon with them. And I think that point was actually made earlier very nicely by Bruce Knight. Thanks for that. So shifting gears now, land potential. This is something that I'm very concerned about. Understanding what works where fundamentally requires an understanding of what NRCS has been working on for years, which is soils vary. But again, it's often the farmers that say it best. So rangeland condition has to do with the potential of the place. You're going to manage something, but you don't know where you are. We debate this a lot. We go out, we forget to take a shovel, and this is what happens. some of us are optimistic. More perennial grass. We're standing on a bunch of annuals right there. And it will rain, so it'll get green. Others are even more optimistic. Okay, so basically we need to see beyond what we see because that can help you decide what to do next. Another colleague from Southern Africa. So, a strategy for maximizing return on climate change adaptation investments in drylands, because that is where the money is, in climate change adaptation. And while my concern is that we're losing soil at a phenomenal rate, far faster than the climate is changing, the reality is climate change is coming, we need to deal with it, and that's where the money is going to be, especially, I'm guessing, after the end of the month in Paris, based on everything that I've seen. So I'm actually not going to go through this. I think we've already seen a nice presentation from Bianca talking about some of the same kinds of things. This is really talking about the conservation planning process and applying an understanding of resilience to it. Resilience in the context of what the potential of the land is. Can it recover? Recover to what? For what? But I would like to run through just very briefly, sort of bringing it again down to earth. Again, and I do actually have examples from other parts of the world, but I just happen to have been spending quite a bit of time in Namibia working on various issues. And these are some criollo cattle on a ranch where the rancher has been applying holistic management techniques and trying to use that to increase production. She has also been considering what's being strongly pushed and actually subsidized, which is what they call debushing there, or the removal of shrubs and woody biomass. But really doing this without a lot of context about what the potential of the land is. The only thing that we really have right now globally is the global agroecological zoning system. And if you haven't played around with this, it's really kind of fun. And they've really actually done a very good job with available global data on predicting potential yields for virtually every major crop in the world under a wide range of climate scenarios and three different nutrient input scenarios. Okay? And so in terms of a relative tool of what's possible, it's pretty cool. But again, what is it relying on from a soils perspective? Pretty sparse, right? And even if you have a really good soil map, all you've got is a soil map unit, you still don't know what your soil map unit component is. So from a farmer perspective, not so helpful. In this particular case, this is northern Namibia, the contrasts are actually quite extreme. I thought that North Dakota was crazy because of all of its glacial landscapes and so forth and the high level of variability, and it is. But actually, the contrasts from a crop production perspective are not as great as what northern Namibia deals with, which is basically an aeolian mantle on a fine textured subsurface. And the aeolian mantle can be quite deep, meters and meters. And so then you have these little pans that pop up where crop production is actually possible, even during drought years, right next door where they're not. Obviously mapped as one massive soil map unit and always will be. So what this farmer's done, though, rancher, is, I think, just wonderful. She's actually started to collect data. And what she started to collect data on is the stuff she cares about, which is her cows and the rain. And so you can see, actually, her management strategy here is illustrated here in the stocking rate in kilograms per hectare. Okay, you can do that in animal units, whatever. But basically kilograms per hectare of livestock, and this is what she was told to do by the advisors from Alan Savory's group with the holistic management, is just keep increasing the number of animals because you want more animal impact, and you will then increase production. Well, she's got the data to show it hasn't really worked out quite so well. The production in kilograms per hectare, even though you've got more animals, you're getting the same amount of meat. So now imagine what those cows look like. Okay? More importantly, they're still eating and they're still walking around. And at some point, there's going to be a drought. And so the question I asked sitting at their kitchen table was, what's your financial resilience? How much of your herd can you afford to destock when it stops raining? Okay? So a management strategy that has certain risks. And as soil scientists, we don't think about this. But that was the key question to ask. I could have gone out and dug holes with her for all afternoon. The key question was, how quickly and how far can you destock? Because your management strategy depends on it, and your exposure is now twice as great as it was before in 1997. Back to rangeland soil health. They're eating more, they're trampling more, soil cover is declining, wind erosion is increasing. The sand got there, not because it fell from the sky, but it blew in, and it can blow out. These are Aeolian landscapes. With wind erosion, soil quality can and will decline. So, that's not the biggest risk. The biggest risk is we need more food. Okay? And some of that I showed you is actually class 3 land. It can be managed sustainably most of the time, probably not during an extreme drought, which occurs fairly often. So, again, looking at this from a holistic perspective, I'm a rangeland scientist, I'm a rangeland soil scientist. I don't think about rangelands, I think about land. Rangeland happens to be the current use of that land, the current land cover. And this is not restricted to Namibia. Like I said, I overloaded this. This is quinoa production in Bolivia. They crop every other year, like we do in every third year, actually, similar to what we do in eastern Washington. Highly wind erodible soils, a fairly extreme situation. But this production system and the mechanization of this system has pulled an entire generation out of poverty. The next generation perhaps doesn't need this land. As the Earth, we do, as a global population, but the individual populations benefited from that. So Ratan Lal in the Washington Post, I think, was quoted recently as saying something to the effect, and it was actually quoted in the opening plenary, that it's not a question of will agriculture have impacts, it's what are the impacts and what are the ones that we're willing to tolerate. So basically what we're trying to do is avoid a wreck. And I don't even know how to pronounce that. I've been to Iceland now half a dozen times teaching, and I still don't know how you say that. But anyway, I really like the image. So ending on a maybe part of a solution, something, a project that we've been working on, mobile apps. So we're trying to develop something called the Land Potential Knowledge System, which is basically a suite of apps connected to cloud-based global databases and models. And many thanks to the Climate Corp, we're trying to do for individual small farmers and open data, open access, what Climate Corp is trying to do for those that can afford to access it on a global scale. That's oversimplifying it, but I think they're really great complementary efforts, and we're glad to see folks taking advantage of big data. It's also a system for storing and accessing, for sharing, selecting relevant data, and then ultimately interpreting it. We see this as an opportunity not only to figure out what the potential of your land is, but also to then monitor changes, feed that information back up to the cloud, and then to identify others who are dealing with similar issues based on their land. So basically a farmer dating system based on similar farms, right, around the world. How will it work? Again, you can think about a precision ag analogy, except this is your sensor, and often we'll have sensors attached to it. So you've got an upload, location, a soil profile description, which is provided by the user. We guide them through that process using embedded videos and so forth. That links to soil surveys and databases, and based on this combination, we predict what their soil profile really is, recognizing that not everybody's really good at that hand texture thing, even with the prompts and tutorials we have. That can be fed back to the phone. We're starting to work with NRCS now in the soil survey division on basically using this as a way to crowdsource and update some of the efforts there. But it also then feeds into simulation models and links to local knowledge, because now you actually know what local knowledge is relevant because you know what soil map unit component you're on. You know what your soil actually is. That can be then used to predict potential production and erosion for a range of management systems. Again, site specific for that farmer's land, not for what that farmer's map unit is, which may or may not be their land. And then finally, identifying management options. So we're working with WOCAT, obviously trying to get into the conservation practices database of NRCS. It's actually a set of PDFs, which makes it a little challenging. And then working in the future on other kinds of things, body condition score, crop monitoring, et cetera. And then ultimately feeding all this back in. So the current status, we've got a couple of apps out. They're available on Android. They'll be available on Apple in early 2016. If you go to landpotential.org, you can sign up and we'll send you a message. We don't spam. We'll just send you one message and tell you it's available. We already have something where you can get one-click access to long-term climate. It's kind of nice when you're driving around an area you're not familiar with to find out what the climate is. I don't really want to know what Minnesota's climate is. I'm from New Mexico, so I haven't clicked on that here. I think it's too cold. So really simple inputs. We're trying to use a lot of graphics, limited language, and also people like poking at things on phones. Outputs right now, we don't have a lot. But we did want to give people some feedback, so we give them plant available water holding capacity for their inputs. And then a data portal, it's kind of cool. As soon as it goes up, you can go on and you can find out what your friend has been digging holes in the middle of the Congo or in their backyard. In the near future, we've actually got this functional, but we're not comfortable enough yet with running Apex in areas that it hasn't necessarily been calibrated. Eventually, we'll be moving to an ensemble model approach and probably connecting with EASA and AGMIP and some of the others, just starting those conversations, but certainly being able to provide people with at least relative productivity and erosion for a range of management systems and soils. Partnerships, it's all completely based on partnerships. This is a USAID-funded project with a lot of support from the Agricultural Research Service, but we're not going to create this whole thing. It's really about partnering with organizations that are doing other things. And to that end, we're looking at a lot of white labeling options, kind of like detergent, where we don't really care if it's the USDA ARS label on it or somebody else's label on it. We just want to get people out there collecting data, looking critically at the evidence, and making decisions. So with that, I'll close for questions. Thank you.
Do we have questions for Dr. Herrick? Yes.
Yeah, Jeff, thank you for your talk. You made several allusions to the current range management state and transition models, whereas the only reason the rangeland community and the Society for Range Management still uses the term rangeland health is due to your efforts in putting up these indicators. One of the things that I think is very relevant is your assessment of why the rangeland health, as put in by your indicators of soil health, failed to make any changes in rangeland management when everybody was sort of going on to the state and transition models for the threat. I mean, a couple of the presidents for the Society for Range Management said, back in the mid-90s, that there was a lost cause for rangeland health because everyone just wanted to go back to condition and trend through the ecological site state and transition models. So your perspectives of why, despite of all your really great work, it failed to make any sort of real progress very valuable.
Boy, that's a complicated question. So
what I'm saying is, why do you think your indicators of rangeland health, which are based a lot on soil health, failed to become the sort of like the paradigm for rangeland management?
So the question is, why I have to ask the question in a way because I'm not sure I agree with the question. But anyway, why have the indicators of rangeland health failed to become the paradigm for rangeland management? And
you look in the NRC handbook, and it's all about state and transition models.
Okay, as opposed to the state and transition models. So the two are actually highly integrated, okay? And so there are actually... The NRC handbook that he's referring to was written specifically to ecological site descriptions, but ecological site descriptions include state and transition models. They also include the rangeland health reference sheet. And in fact, there are two completely different things that are used complementarily. So the state and transition model tells you basically what your thresholds and your transitions are among your different states. The rangeland health is then used to understand the processes within those states. So you can think of soil health or rangeland health system as being the soil health complement to state and transition models. So in croplands, we tend to think of we're going to go from this management system to this management system, right? And then we use soil health to understand what's really happening. And there was a wonderful illustration Bianca had of those two soils where one was doing just fine in terms of pH and nutrients, but the physics and the biology were trashed. And on the other side, we had one photo from Doran Cox that showed the opposite. And so what we found is that both of these have actually been widely adopted by the agencies, right? So they're both state and transition models, and the rangeland health assessment protocols have been universally, virtually, adopted at the national level by BLM and NRCS. In terms of the producers themselves, boy, that's as variable as it's ever going to be. I mean, there are lots of different approaches, lots of consultants out there and so forth.
I just wanted to remind you, you said several times that the plant communities were very considered very healthy, but the soils were being very highly degraded. So I would...
Okay.
That's why I would...
Okay, great. So the contrast between the plant communities and the soils, that actually, maybe I overemphasized that. That's actually fairly uncommon. Usually there's a pretty tight relationship between degradation of the plant community and the soils. But this is, I think we can continue the conversations later. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much.